One of the things that made JP Morgan Chase a successful bank is Jamie Dimon always valued the risk people. You know, he didn't think risk was a place where a failed investment banker went to be parked for the rest of his or her career, right? He saw them as like incredible input into making sure the bank was making wise decisions and managing their balance sheet as stewards.
Welcome to Against Consensus, a weekly podcast in collaboration with FinNews. I'm your host, Angelo Calvello, and in each 30-minute episode, I interview asset owners, asset managers, service providers, and innovators who are challenging conventional thinking to create better investment outcomes for their beneficiaries and clients. Our goal is to elevate the conversation and help you make smarter investment decisions, always with a little edginess along the way. Welcome to Against Consensus. I'm Angelo Calvello, and every week I sit down with someone who's actually pushing institutional investing forward. Somebody who has decided that consensus thinking is the ceiling, not a destination. And today's guest is exactly that kind of person, Anurang Chandra. Anurang is the trustee of the $4.5 billion San Jose Federated Employees Retirement Fund, where he chairs both the investment committee and the joint personnel committee. He also serves as CIO of a single family office with an attached venture studio. And he sits on the investment committees for a multifamily office in Dubai and the San Mateo Community College Foundation. His career spans asset allocation, investing, and operations, and it has consistently landed outside the conventional playbook. We'll put his full bio in the show notes. Now, Anurang and I have spent the past month or so having the kind of honest conversations about AI that most people in the industry are still having only behind closed doors. Today, we're having them on the record. We agreed to cover two topics. The first is how San Jose has built a governance structure that actually empowers staff to explore and integrate AI within a fiduciary framework. That leads into the broader conversation about the plan's culture, how the investment team works together, and how all of this connects to retaining great people. Frankly, what San Jose has built sounds a lot like TPA in practice, even if nobody at San Jose is calling it that. The second topic is AI as a portfolio question. Where does Anurang see the opportunity? Where does he see the risks? And how is he thinking about both for the $4.5 billion fund?
Hey, do I look okay, by the way? I look pretty good, don't
yes.
I? All right.
You look
good.
Great.
Well, you sound good. You look good. I appreciate you wearing not the hoodie this time. That's nice. I like
that. You didn't want the Silicon Valley vibe out of me with the hoodie? My wife's like, you wear way too many hoodies.
Oh, man. I wear one hoodie. It says Fred Hampton was murdered. You remember who Fred Hampton was?
Yeah, a nice hoodie. Oh, wow.
Slain Black Panther leader from my high school. So, yeah.
Wow. Man, you have some really interesting real-world connections.
Man, I can't say it here. We're recording because you might be deposed. So we have to leave it there. All right, let me let it rip. Okay, here we go. Anurang, welcome to Against Consensus. It's great to have you on the show.
Wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Let's go to the warm-up questions. Just get you loose and get you going. You ready?
Okay.
Mountain or beach?
I'm a mountain guy. I love hiking, and I'm not a big fan of sand in the wrong places. So I'm definitely going with mountains.
Okay. Contrarian or consensus?
Contrarian.
I knew that one. but this one I don't know. Is it spreadsheet or gut feel?
Man, it's a binary. Yeah, I got to go with gut feel.
Okay. Operator or allocator?
Allocator.
And long game or quick win?
Long game.
Done. Okay. See, those were easier than the last ones.
Yeah, they were. But I mean, a couple of those, you know, when you do your Myers-Briggs, sometimes you'll kind of shade like 55-45 for introvert versus extrovert. There were a couple there where I had to hesitate. It wasn't like an obvious binary. I'm only gut feel, but, you know, I got to answer the questions the way they're posed.
Damn right.
I play by the rules.
Binary. You got it.
Yeah.
All right. So you and I have spent, you know, the past month or so having the kind of honest conversations about AI that most people in our industry are still having behind closed doors. And today, I think it's going to be pretty cool. We're going to share what we've been talking about with the audience. So let's get into it. And I want to begin by talking about AI and how San Jose Federated has built this fiduciary framework that empowers staff to explore and integrate AI. Tell me about the framework. And why did you and your fellow trustees start the plan's exploration of AI by focusing on governance?
I think we're no different than most systems and most trustees. Everything starts with governance, right? And that's our primary role as fiduciaries, is to lay and establish a governance framework for the way the plan operates. And, you know, the interesting thing about AI and all of the hullabaloo around it over the past couple of years, it sort of dovetailed into a big governance overhaul project that we had done a few years later and that we continue to be mindful of and tweaking and making sure that we are adhering to best practices and really ultimately enabling our CEO who runs the retirement office and our CIO who manages the $10 billion in pension AUM, and that's between two plans, mine, the Federated, and the police and fire, that we equip them to be able to do what they do best. I mean, ultimately, this is about empowering, but as fiduciaries, we've got to lay the guardrails. So, I mean, as it relates to AI, you know, you always, I think in life, or at least for me, you start with some simple frameworks, because if you just dive into the trees and you don't take a look at the forest, it's very easy to get lost in jargon. And when it comes to AI, it is technical, and it's also moving very quickly. So, you know, we set some parameters, like along a continuum. Do we want our investment staff to benefit from the productivity enhancements that AI can bring in their day-to-day jobs? The answer is a resounding yes. But on the other end, you know, the tension is, do we want AI making our investment decisions? Do we want AI doing our strategic asset allocation? Do we want AI obviating the human being? And we're not prepared yet to trust AI to that level. And maybe the answer is we never will be. And so we had to figure out how to treat AI basically like a brilliant analyst who's never allowed to vote. How do we get the most productivity that we can out of these systems so that each of our highly talented investment professionals are on steroids, but they're not allowing the AI to do their job for them? So that's at the most basic, highest level abstraction when I think about AI as someone who has to pay close attention to governance for a major pension system.
I mean, it's kind of interesting. You're focusing on productivity. You know, I think there's an ROI there, but you're hesitant, and maybe more than hesitant, bringing AI into the investment process, decision-making process. And you kind of tipped your hand, man, by saying it. You may never be that comfortable.
Look, we might be, because the technology is evolving. You know, these inference layers on these AI models are getting more and more intelligent, more qualitative, able to synthesize data. And so, but you know, you need to be able to explain what's inside the black box. Ultimately, if you are a CEO of a corporation or the CIO of a major pension system, you have to be able to explain to your trustees what's going on, right? We've had black box blowups all the way back to long-term capital just in quant trading. And I know I'm now stepping into your domain. You've forgotten more about quant trading than I will ever know, but I just use it as a analog, because if we just at this stage in the AI evolution surrender ourselves to its capabilities, we are taking, I believe, as a fiduciary, some outsized risks on not fully understanding what the algorithms are doing, what they're saying, what data sets they're trained on, where they might be hallucinating or coming up with false positives or false negatives. So look, that was the highest abstraction. I think if you come down one level, just thinking in terms of framework, maybe we can talk in terms of an outer ring, a middle ring, and an inner ring. And over time, our orientation to these different rings will change. At the outer ring, AI can freely assist with document ingestion, you know, SIMs, pitch decks, manager questionnaires, screening against qualitative criteria, certainly doing market research. I think it's fantastic for that. That's pure productivity, and you've conceded that to me. And yes, we are comfortable with that. Our team is looking at a product right now that will help them with workflow, because ultimately their job is an assembly line process of bringing in managers, evaluating them, and then putting them into a portfolio and making sure that on a risk-adjusted basis, they're the best bet, and then making sure that that manager in that asset class is doing his or her job in the overall strategic asset allocation and risk budget that we've set for them. So that's great. Then you've got the middle ring where you can use AI to generate scores, red flags, comparative analysis, and I actually think it's great for that. I mean, you can ingest, 20 private credit manager strategies and start to do a lot of really powerful compare and contrast that you couldn't do, or it would take too many human hours to do previously. And we're a small staff, small but mighty, but nonetheless small. But, in the process of doing that, I think the key governance principle is the explainability requirement. Like, our policy has to mandate that whatever that AI output is that might be used in a committee memo or in a committee discussion have like some human, understandable, digestible rationale attached to it. So I start to feel like that's a hybrid. Maybe I'm coming out of your box a little bit and giving AI a little bit more of a role. Remember, it's a non-voting investment analyst, as I said early on. And then the inner ring is, AI is doing your manager selections. It's doing your portfolio construction decisions. And I cop to sitting here on June 2nd, 2026, not comfortable with our investment team letting AI have that role in their processes yet.
I mean, you ride in a Waymo, I assume, right?
I have not ridden in a Waymo, only because I've been too lazy to download the app, but I see them all over the place in San Francisco and Palo Alto. Yes, yeah. I will eventually ride in a Waymo.
So what Waymo and other forms of autonomous technology has solved is the optimization problem, getting from point A to point B in the legally fastest and safest way possible. And solving that problem is really hard because you have this kind of continuous changing environment, a lot like the markets. And people get in Waymos, have no idea how they work, but they get there. We've solved edge cases, and we can look at Waymo's traffic safety record. It's amazing. I mean, the last time I looked, there was one fatality, and that fatality was the result of a Tesla going through a stop sign or a stoplight and killing and crashing into the Waymo and killing the passenger. So we could solve autonomous driving. I would think you'd start leaning a little bit more in that inner ring to maybe saying, can it help us with portfolio optimization? Because it's reinforcement learning that's inside that Waymo at the heart of it that's making those decisions. We used it at Rosetta. We showed for 5 years it worked pretty well. But you raised the point, you're not a fiduciary in that Waymo. That's the difference, I think. Am I right? You're just a passenger.
And a passenger wants to stay safe. Though if we try to create an apples to apples framework, I guess Waymo has a board of directors and Waymo certainly has liabilities that it's got to be concerned, right? The business model breaks down if too many people are dying, right? So that's a little bit of an analog. Look, what I would say to autonomous driving is I was looking at autonomous driving companies back in 2013 for potential investment, right? So the iterative, it's a bounded environment with a lot of dynamic actors inside those bounded environments because they know what the streets look like. They know where the traffic lights are and all that kind of stuff. And then as you pointed out, right, there's a ton of dynamism. The incremental progress that we made was 15, 20 years. I might even be wrong, might be longer than that. So I'm not suggesting AI can't get there, but I think if I were to stick with your metaphor, I'd feel like we're still in 2015 with autonomous driving as it relates to letting AI drive a $10 billion pension portfolio.
Which is one of the reasons why Julia and I closed Rosetta, because we couldn't convince people, even with track record testing, safeguards, QA, that this thing could do it. But let me twist it a little bit. Let's say you have a manager come to you that's AI-driven, black box. And I know you have staff that's qualified to do all this, but you still chair the investment committee at the end of the day. I mean, the manager, I'll give you an easy one. Let's say somehow Medallion opens up again. And you get a chance to get a piece of Medallion, okay? And yet, you got to admit, that's a pretty dark black box, am I right?
Yeah.
So what do you do there? Now, this is not AI in that inner circle. This is AI as an opportunity,
Correct.
So yes. What do you do?
Yes. I think AI as an investment theme is both an opportunity and a threat. And I think we've got to be open to the opportunities, and we have to be mindful of the threats. So, look, in private credit, most lenders have always priced risk on backward-looking financials. AI changes that information set entirely. Credit managers are now building models that ingest real-time operational data, point-of-sales traffic, web traffic, employee headcount, satellites of parking lot density, like all this kind of stuff. that's somewhat equivalent to a medallion black box, right? And, you know, for us, that becomes a matter of emerging manager risk. You know, is their AI black box sufficiently trained? Does it have a long enough duration for us to feel comfortable? We would do that with a venture manager who's not using AI, but just tells us they have amazing deal flow. Like, you know, they show up in a fund one, we might just begin a relationship and just track and just get a little bit of history. And again, as you pointed out, those judgment calls would be made by our CIO and investment staff. We have fully delegated manager selection to them, which I think is the appropriate thing to do. Though I think at the municipal level, we're an outlier. I think that's more common with the larger state plans. But yeah, we, of course, like I hope our staff is open to folks who are manipulating AI for alpha generation. I think there are probably really good funds doing that now across the spectrum of different asset classes. And I think it's only going to intensify, you know. Yeah, because this section of our conversation is very different than the how we use it operationally internally. Like when you think about the way we're using internally, I think another great analogy there is the way in the medical device regulatory model, the FDA distinguishes between tools that assist a clinician versus tools that make the diagnosis, right? So now, if someone as a market participant and manager with a strategy believes they can use AI to make the diagnosis on a white space where they can generate a little more yield on a risk or improve the risk-adjusted return or generate more equity alpha, yes, I'm excited by that. I think we're going to see a lot of that.
I appreciate your excitement, but I'm still talking about a black box. And what you've told me about managers using credit card data, et cetera, those are alternative data sources.
True.
That are, you know, maybe structured, unstructured. But at the end of the day, I'm talking about an autonomous process that now, regardless of the data, whether it's traditional or alternative, they put it into a black box. And I believe nobody knows, I don't think. Medallion is a black box that uses some type of artificial intelligence to make these investment decisions. So, I mean, I get it. You want to be open to the opportunities. And that takes us into the team. If we could pivot there quickly, go into the team.
Yeah.
You set up this fiduciary framework, and it's clearly larger than AI because you talked about how you did an overhaul.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's maybe contemporaneous with AI, but AI is part of it. You empower staff. You've talked about, and you just mentioned here, you know, you want your staff to look critically at all these opportunities, AI or not AI opportunities that are coming to them, whether it's a hedge fund manager using AI, private credit, you're open to that. But tell me more about this empowerment and this culture that is within the system that's part of this governance structure, I assume. What's the culture like with this small but very good team? And I think you told me you had 11 team members. Am I right?
Yeah, and that's including some of the operational staff as well.
Well, you need them. I mean, you got to have those people, even if you don't want them. Let's be honest. You got to pay them.
Yeah, so. Of course. No, and I mean, look, I think they're critical.
Absolutely.
I think one of the things that made JP Morgan Chase a successful bank is Jamie Dimon always valued the risk people. You know, he didn't think risk was a place where a failed investment banker went to be parked for the rest of his or her career, right? He saw them as like incredible input into making sure the bank was making wise decisions and managing their balance sheet as stewards. I guess there could be two ways to answer that. The one is the governance framework. And I'll throw that in there because that's really the only part that I could even take partial credit for. You know, when I joined the board within about a year, we began a big governance review. And I think I've told you this when we've had conversations offline that I like to tell this analogy. I was a pretty poor student or ADD distracted, couldn't really take notes. And when I was in eighth grade, they started ramping up the game because they wanted all the kids to get ready for high school when grades matter. And, Thursday would roll around and we always have math tests on Fridays. And I'd go to my friend Susie Klepper and say, hey, listen, I need your notes. Otherwise, I'm going to fail this test. And she's the most generous person. She'd always share them with me and she'd save my bacon. And I learned a lifelong lesson from Susie, which is it's better to draft off of other people who are really good at something and try and reinvent the wheel on your own. So we went and hired a consultant out of Canada because the Canadians, I think, have been the gold standard when it comes to managing pension capital. And everything that goes into it, including governance. So that was number one, is, you know, we drafted off of folks and really evaluated their best practices and what would apply to us. So that led to a new IPS, that led to a new risk study with a different consultant to really understand how much volatility our portfolio could bear. And I'll actually spend a second on that. It sounds like it's a digression from the governance and culture question, but it really isn't, because we needed to know how much risk we could take. We're an underfunded pension system. We lowered our discount rate twice since I've been on the board. So we've actually, when you do that, you actually make your long-term liabilities worse. And so I think we were around 50% funded when I joined. I'm happy to report we're almost 70% now. It's been and 80% is considered healthy, though we're obviously shooting for 100%. And so we came up with a risk model where we could take, and I mean, if you want to improve your funded status through investment returns, you need to take risk. The problem with taking risk is you can end up on the wrong side of that trade. So we tried to figure out what was sort of the maximum volatility we felt comfortable with. We looked at all the worst drawdowns in capital markets history, back to the Great Depression. We stochastically modeled what other ones could look like. And of course, it's art, not science, because I have no idea what the next black swan will actually look like. But we just needed a stress test to see how far out on the risk curve could we get without, you know, injuring our ability to make those timely monthly payments to retirees. So we put that in place. We put an investment policy in place with a lot of those risk principles around it. And, you know, one of the things we copied in the governance model was this delegated authority. I am not picking on anyone in particular, but I've sat in board meetings for 10 years, 11 board meetings per year. I've missed a couple, but that roughly gives you a sense that I've probably been in close to 100 of these meetings. And there are some incredibly talented people who understand so many aspects of pension stewardship, the liabilities, the actuarial work. We have to deal with disability claims, all sorts of stuff. But there are very few people on these boards who understand investments. And the idea that boards of trustees can go into a closed session and make effective manager selection decisions is something that I don't agree with. I think you hire a staff who is skilled at doing that, and then you empower them to do that. And I think that was probably one of the stronger governance changes that we made. And so now that leads to your culture question. We had a phenomenal CIO, Prabhu Palani, who built that culture. He hired talented people. He told them, you know what, you're going to get paid a government wage and you're not going to get a bonus or any upside tied to the performance of the plan, but you're going to love working here because you're going to grow. You're going to get to work with some of the greatest managers in the world. You're going to get autonomy in your your sandbox. And I'm going to be here as a seasoned veteran with an open door who's going to coach you and help you develop your career. And he built that culture brick by brick. And I believe it's to the point where it's a bit institutionalized. So much so that when we looked for the next CIO candidate, it was incredibly important to us that person fits San Jose's culture, not that our staff would tack to his or her culture. And people who are good leaders and good culture builders, maybe there's a playbook, maybe they're listening to some great podcasts or reading some business textbooks, but I think a lot of it comes down to that personal force of personality. And I guess we'll pat ourselves on the back as a board for hiring that CIO, but the rest is really his great work.
Okay, so built it brick by brick was what you just told me. In my mind's eye, I'm assuming building it brick by brick, not building silos. Am I right? That's not part of the culture.
Love that. Thank you. I wish I had remembered to say that, and I'm so glad you jogged my memory. There's a big movement right now in the pension world to talk about TPA versus SAA. And I've been a part of a lot of those conversations, and I've tried to appreciate and understand TPA, really struggling to do so. But I'm a slow learner, and eventually in the last couple of months, I had an aha. If you're a giant $300, $400, $500 billion plan, I understand why TPA matters. It's really hard for the left arm to know what the right arm is doing, left hand, right hand. We don't have that problem. We have 10 investment professionals who meet on a Monday who actually discuss each other's asset classes and the manager selection process. It's incredibly collaborative. So every one of our investment officers has a view into what the other investment officers are doing. So we don't silo them just to prune the two or three trees in the forest that they're responsible for. They get to see, they get to be in a helicopter or in a drone's eye view of what the entire portfolio looks like. And I think that's been a real asset for our performance.
I would assume it leads to employee retention because you're giving these men and women, as you use the term delegated authority, autonomy. Am I right? Yeah. Do you see much turnover?
We've had one person turnover that was due to a life event, not due to wanting to leave San Jose. Otherwise, I'm just hedging a little bit here because my memory's not what it used to be, but over 10 years, I think that's the only person we lost.
Do you get a lot of inbounds, people looking to work at the plan?
Yes, I believe that the CIO does, and the other officers will get resumes shot over like, hey, if you're ever looking, we're interested. Yeah, for sure.
Okay. I'm going to come back to that in a minute, but your comment about TPA, I mean, I've heard this from others. John Grable had a similar view. You know, there's a subtext that we're doing TPA without using the letters. We're empowering staff. We got a governance structure. You know, we're breaking down silos. I'm going to guess in these weekly meetings, there's competition for capital. If somebody's got an idea and there's, you know, you don't have a lot of liquidity, you're going to fight for that idea and somebody may have a better idea. I mean, all this kind of goes under a TPA umbrella without the letters.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, you're hesitating.
No. I think that's right. I'm just going to adjust it a little bit, if you don't mind. Every investment officer has their allocation, right? The strategic asset allocation is set by the board. That is a critical fiduciary duty. So we set that. So the idea that, you know, if someone's a little underweighted, and let's say we want private equity to be 7% of the portfolio, but it's only 5%, and private credit now says, hey, let me grab those 2 points. That's not happening. So we are an SAA shop. However, what is happening is just to stick with the private equity portfolio manager and the private credit portfolio manager, the private credit portfolio manager is saying, hey, I don't think that's a great manager. And here's why. Let me tell you from my perspective in the credit world why I don't think you've thought through these things and you might have a blind spot as you're presenting this particular manager or vice versa. So it's at that level where I think we have that cross-pollination taking place.
It's a good example. I like that. Thank you. I want to go back to AI just quickly here. We've talked about the culture. We framework, culture, empowerment of staff, the three, I guess they're concentric circles that you talked about. And we talked about inbounds, people wanting to work. I'm going to ask you the question. Given where you're situated in the country and given the framework you have that's encouraging employees, team members to use AI in a specific way within guardrails, would you rather hire an AI ninja or an experienced PM?
It's a great question.
It's one you've heard before, man. You know it.
I know. By the way, I think the audience should know that you and I met when you moderated a panel at the Public Funds Roundtable on which I was a participant. And you were a fantastic moderator. And you definitely had this as a gotcha question for me at the end. And we didn't prep for it. So that was a little bit sneaky. Look, I think the answer I gave is probably the answer I'll stick with. Last year, I would have said the experienced professional. This year, I am hesitant. Next year, I think it'll be the AI ninja. And here's why. Because, what are the people at the top doing in any professional services system or any, investment shop? You're really relying on your judgment. I mean, I have an issue with where the judgment's going to come from in the future because all of us started out at the bottom of the pyramid doing the grunt work and whatever our profession was. And that's how just making contact with so many different transactions or client projects or consulting projects, it's how you started to learn how the game is played and develop your own judgment. Now, I'm in a position now to be able to cheat and say, well, maybe at that bottom layer, if I've got a crack shot AI 27-year-old who's got enough business experiences, 4 or 5 years out of college, and then also can help me manipulate AI, just the amount of volume of work that we can ingest if you point these models in the right direction. The number of humans you're going to need at the top who are providing that judgment. I mean, and this may be making you happy because I keep talking about keeping the human in the loop, but I do think there may be fewer and fewer of us who need to be in the loop. And so, yeah, and this stuff is moving faster than I thought it would. I attended an annual meeting about 5 years ago where, you know, one of the top five luminaries in the tech community here in Silicon Valley was a guest speaker and talked about all of the disruption of jobs that would happen within the ensuing 3 years. And this was up in Napa, so I drove home about 90 minutes and I kept thinking to myself, well, of course, every single time you're going to take that guy's opinion over mine, but I've been around for 20 plus years and I've got my own information sources and have made contact with this market. That seems a little alarmist to me. Well, as 3 years came and went, he wasn't 100% right, but he was a lot closer to accurate than I was. And I think I had a bit of a failure of imagination at what we would be able to do at the inference layer with these AI systems. And every day I continue to be incrementally and marginally impressed, but that compounds. And so, yeah, I mean, I think a year from now, my answer would be that I'd want that 27-year-old ninja.
Got it. And let's go to the second theme quickly here. And that is, I mean, you know, yes, you're a trustee and you're the head of the IC, but you also have other responsibilities in terms of investments, you know, whether it's advising in a multifamily office or affiliated with a family office. And again, given your geography, I mean, let's talk about AI as an investment opportunity, you know, as a theme. Where are the opportunities that you see? And, you know, the risks, where do the risks live? I mean, we've got a couple big IPOs yeah. coming up here. And if you could, situate it within the portfolio, you know, within the San Jose portfolio. I know staff's going to make decisions, but I'm sure if you have ideas, you share them with them, given your network.
Yeah, I do have a bunch of thoughts on that. Look, when it comes to the specifics, like is SpaceX worth $2 trillion pre-money valuation as it goes public? I always hesitate to answer those questions. I have my own opinion, but really the market ultimately dictates. And are we in a bubble? You know, I don't know. Yes, we're probably somewhere in a bubble, but I don't know when it began and I don't know when it will end. I've never had that crystal ball. My attitude toward bubbles is if you believe it's the Dutch tulips, run screaming. If you think it's the internet, if you think it's the railroad, if you think it's radio or television, lean into it, because even after those bubbles burst, you had a really nice geometric progression afterward for at least a decade, if not longer, in which there were some really nice returns to be had. So I don't have really defined thoughts on how Anthropic is going to do with its recently announced IPO. I don't have an opinion on NVIDIA's valuation. But what I think I am doing, well, I know what I'm doing, and what I think is in the best interest of a plan like San Jose to do is to see how the technology itself can embed itself into existing investment classes, and which could either turn it into a positive opportunity or a threat. So I already earlier in the conversation talked about private credit. I think that's an underappreciated opportunity and a great application of AI. I'll give you a kooky one. I know of a company, and they're actually going to put a fund alongside this. What they went out and did, this is a real assets and infrastructure example, if you were to bucket it into an asset class. They went and they got all of the public county recorded data on oil and gas exploration in Texas and Kansas, New Mexico, just the regions that have produced oil in the past. Because I guess it turns out that when you have to provide your county, when you create these reports and share them with the county, there's all sorts of data on geothermal pockets as well. That was just information that wasn't necessarily essential to the oil and gas exploration, but it's there in these reports. So they have gone and crunched all of these reports, put them into an AI model, and started bringing in other sources of data, geological data, current survey data, all that kind of stuff, to try to find interesting pockets that might also be close to electric grid hookup links, right? And so, you know, the idea of starting to buy land around that, start to build, are we energy starved right now in the AI age? I'm being told we're struggling to produce energy. Will that ultimately end up being a great investment? I don't know. But I do know that is a totally new way to think about the problem statement and investment opportunity. So, you know, and again, we talked about AI, like I talked about satellite imagery and AI-driven stuff. There's things you can do there in insurance products. There's things you can do there in commercial real estate. All sorts of things that can influence the way a manager in one of those asset classes makes money. I think the secondaries market is going to become more liquid and probably better valued as a result of AI. I think certain event-driven and credit strategies, I mean, these NLP models trained on regulatory filings and earnings calls, transcripts, people have been doing this already, but just the volume at which you can do it now, I think is probably going to create little white space gaps that event-driven fund managers can exploit. Now, there's the other side of the coin of that too, which is if everyone's doing it, it could arbitrage out some of the advantage.
Yep, we've seen that before.
Right? So there's that.
Yeah.
You know, and then the threats of the portfolio. Everyone knows that all of the SaaS companies have gotten slaughtered. Some of them probably excessively so. But look, I have an example of a company that went to one of the biggest SaaS companies and said, look, we're thinking about doing some of the stuff in-house. We think we can vibe code it. And the truth was they couldn't because their whole customer data platform is really sitting inside of this really big, prominent SaaS company. But you know what they were able to do? They were able to do a new three-year contract and avoid the mandatory 20% hike in price that they'd experienced every prior time when they had tried, when they did a three-year contract renewal. So like, hey, even the best position SaaS companies are probably going to see a little bit of a hit to their revenue. And if you're just a simple feature and function and you really don't have a customer data platform, yeah, I think some of that stuff can be vibe coded away. So I think that's real. I think there's like these very niche things that we don't necessarily think about day to day, but a big part of the private equity model is to get operating fees for the consulting services that they provide. And at least the private equity guys share that now with LPs. Like in the first iteration, they used to keep that for themselves. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure in the age of AI, all of that consulting revenue is going to be as prominent. Like there's just going to be a lot of things that change in these models. And you know, we have to look at every one of our asset classes with fresh eyes and say, is there a role for AI here to improve this? And generate alpha, or is AI going to actually neutralize this and kind of create model homogeneity risk?
Okay. I got two final questions for you. The first one is something we've never talked about, but you're open to it. We've talked a lot about AI. You've got deep experience in venture, separate from your role at San Jose. What do you think about quantum?
I will caveat by saying I'm the farthest thing from a quantum expert.
I think we all are. I think that's what I'm saying.
Look, anytime I look at a frontier technology, I'm kind of a simpleton in that I like a framework to start as opposed to diving into the trees, because I have spent some time with some really smart quantum scientists and I come away with my head spinning. So I'm like, okay, I got to back up here. Just broadly, when I look at any frontier technology, I ask myself, where are we catching this? Like temporally, right now, this moment in time, on the continuum, with one endpoint being science project and the other being commercialization. So do I believe that quantum is going to happen? And you might even want to dig in and say, well, what do you mean by happen? Let me first say yes. I believe right now we're probably a little bit closer to science project than we are commercialization. And the reason that matters is I put my venture hat on. Almost every venture fund is a 10-year fund, maybe 2-year extension, so 10 to 12-year fund. Do I think I would want to be writing seed or series A checks right now into a de novo quantum company? I would be hesitant just because of the time scale. So that's me putting my investor hat on. If I take my investor hat off and I just look at quantum as a emerging technology, yeah, I mean, all of our passwords are going to stop working someday, unless homomorphic encryption is a real thing. But yeah, no, I think there are enough bright minds working at it. I think we have enough compute capacity and power. So yeah, I think long term, but I would not be investing in it right now. There are kind of surround like picks and shovels and some of the surrounding ecosystem in quantum that I think is probably a more interesting place to invest.
Yeah. It's something that's got my attention. I'm not sure I'll ever understand it all, but there's just so much going on in that space. And there's a group in Chicago that has been focusing on this for years, because, you know, they're doing a big quantum research center at the old U.S. Steel area. And yeah. I'm kind of getting into this now, because these men and women, whether they're lawyers, scientists, operators, it's just something new. And I'm, like you, intellectually curious. And it's and getting it firsthand from these men and women has been very helpful. So,
yeah, I mean, I still have trouble understanding. You know, I think it's elusive. Like, I feel like I know what a qubit is.
Oh, me too.
and then, like, if you ask me to explain it 2 days later, my father, nuclear physicist, he used to say he could teach, you know, the basic concepts of nuclear physics to anyone who got an A- in high school physics. The question is, could they retain it? And I unfortunately am that lame student who can kind of get it when it, but then it just doesn't stick with me.
And this isn't my last question. I got one more, but whatever happened to Susie? That helps you with all those math problems. You ever find out what happened to her?
She's still one of my closest friends. We've stayed friends for decades. I won't age
her.
But,
yep.
And she's got an amazing husband who's a good buddy of mine too. We live on different coasts, but I talk to her pretty frequently. And the best thing about Susie, she's raised four phenomenal children, one of whom called me this weekend for a little career advice, which was really rewarding. So,
wow, that's cool.
I am grateful to her. I would not have made it through eighth grade were it not for her. And look, my parents are Indian immigrants. We come from a very education-oriented family and culture, but they didn't understand how the American system worked. And so, you know, when you got to take your SATs and what APs to take if you want to go to a good college, Susie was like in my kitchen cabinet. There were a couple other people who kind of walked me through the ropes. So I'm grateful to her.
Very cool. I'm glad to hear you're still in touch. That's great.
Yeah,
All right,
nice
man. Final question. The worst investment pitch you ever heard.
The worst
investment. You've had time to think about this, man. You know, I teed this up when we tried this before.
You did tee this up, and unfortunately, I probably didn't spend as much time thinking it through. Man, I've heard about 1,000 pitches at this point. I'm lame. I'm not going to come up with anything specific, but I will say the worst pitches I heard were definitely back in the late 90s during the internet 1.0 age, when no one was paying attention to profitability. No one was paying attention to business models. It's like, yeah, you know, we're selling a dollar for 85 cents and we're going to make it up on volume. Like, yeah. You know, like, how does that work? So there were a few ideas where people just thought that they could take very complex supply chain businesses like sporting goods, for instance, and say, oh, you know what, we're just going to put that online. And now, conversely, I actually think that Webvan was ahead of its time. Like, everyone remembers that company is imploding, but they were actually taking a lot of the pieces out of the supply chain, right? They were creating distribution centers and having vans go directly to people's homes. Like, those kinds of businesses I've always liked, where you're creating more efficiency in a supply chain. There's a lot of stuff where people are like, we're just going to slap web UX on top of it. And it's like, well, all you did was, you know, potentially at a cost. I mean, you didn't really explain how this is creating more margins in the business. Anyway, so that I don't have a specific one, but that was probably, things got a lot better when people started realizing that you have to have an actual business model to make money.
You can't just buy the URL pets.com and hope for the best. You know what I mean?
Right. Petrock.com.
Yeah, exactly. Well, hey, this was great. We're going to end it here. I appreciate you coming on and really just kind of laying it all out for me and playing along. This was great, Anurag. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. You really did such a great job of moderating our panel. And then you and I had a couple of impromptu conversations throughout that 2-day event. And I just, I was like, I'm anxious to do this because you're a thoughtful guy.
Oh, thank you. I hope that the final product meets the expectations, and I'm sure it will, because you gave me a lot of content here. So thank you.
Beautiful.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to subscribe to the show on the podcast app of your choice and follow us on the Against Consensus YouTube channel. You can also find episodes at the Against Consensus website, and the show's episodes will be on FinNews' website. Also, it'd be great if you could follow us on LinkedIn. All the links are in the show notes. If you have someone who belongs in this conversation, an asset owner, an asset manager, a service provider, send them my way. If you represent an organization that wants to reach the most sophisticated audience in institutional investing, then let's talk about a sponsorship. And if you're an emerging manager with a genuinely differentiated investment approach, let's talk about creating a custom episode for you that can help you build your brand. And in case you're wondering,
Our music is provided by the Super Trio, courtesy of the Northrop family. No AI-generated music for us. Thank you for your support, and we'll see you next time. Namaste.
All opinions expressed by hosts and guests are solely their own. The information presented in this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only. The host, guests, and their affiliated organizations are not providing investment, legal, tax, or financial advice. Investment strategies discussed may not be suitable for all investors, as individual circumstances may vary.
This episode is brought to you by Castos Productions.